Thank you, Mark. Speaking of 24/7, you know who I'll be calling 24/7, don't you? I'm going to make a statement that sounds a little bit strange, probably, and that is, if we could only see what we do not know. Now, sometimes I'll concede that we don't want to see what we don't, we might not want to see what we don't know, but there's a lot of things that we wish we could see that we don't know. That's just beyond our capability to know or see. And I hope that it becomes clear what I'm talking about as we go along. There are a few expressions that we have. One of them is out of sight, out of mind. Another one is just below the surface. But the title I've chosen for this, and it's ironic that the sermonette was also somewhat in that direction. The title that I have is More Than Meets the Eye. More Than Meets the Eye. So it is sort of a interesting coincidence that both of us have sort of a somewhat similar or along the same lines title. Most things have things going on that we cannot see or that we cannot necessarily know, that we aren't aware of or we don't understand because, as the title implies, there is more than meets the eye. For example, in the political world, there's agendas flying around for almost everything because who in their right mind would open our borders in this country and let everybody come flocking in that wants to come in? There must be an agenda behind it, or that wouldn't happen. As with many things, or probably all things political, there is an agenda behind it. There is more than meets the eye. There are things going on that we don't understand, that is trying to be kept from us, and in a lot of cases, we don't even want to know about, probably. Personally, in our personal interactions, the same thing is true. For the last 50 years, I've been a salesman, and my job has been to try to figure out what people are not saying, because they'll tell you all kinds of things. Whether it's about your product or whether it's why they don't want to buy from you or all kinds of things. But it's what they're not saying that is really the important thing. It's the same way when we deal with our wives, with when we go to buy a car or all the kind of things. But especially like oftentimes when we talk to our wives about something, we don't really necessarily come out and tell them exactly what it is that we're trying to accomplish here. And I'm sure, since I'm not a female, but I'm sure that it works both ways, that they do the same thing to us. I know I'm treading on dangerous territory here, but I really don't care. Because that's the truth. There are things that are not said, and the things that are not said are oftentimes more important than the things that are said. There's more to it than meets the eye. In our spiritual life, it's the same way. There are things going on in the spirit world or in our spiritual life that we don't exactly understand, don't really know exactly what it means or what it's all about. We wonder what it is that's going on just beyond what we can see, just beyond the realm that we live in, which is the physical world. Why? Or how is it going to turn out? How are those things going to turn out? Why are those things there? What is it that we can't see that we wish we could? Well, God has a plan to make us better. And some of the things that are going on spiritually, most of the things that are going on spiritually, if we're connected to God, which we are, and which we should be, and which we hope to be, there are a lot of things that are going on that God is allowing to enter our life that we don't know about. We may not like it, and oftentimes we don't, because it can be painful. We may not like what's going on or happening to us, but God has a purpose and a plan for us, because it may hurt. That's one of the reasons we may not like it, because it hurts. We make plans, and then we wonder, why in the world is this plan not working out? Why are we having such a difficult time? We were going to go this way, and all of a sudden we're going this way, and we don't know why. But God has a purpose to make us better. It may be uncomfortable, and oftentimes is. Very often it's uncomfortable what happens to us and what's going on below the surface or just beyond what we can see, just beyond the scope of what we can see. It may confuse us. I know I've been confused with things that have happened. I know that I've had prayers for things, and I, in one particular case, and I've talked about this before, I had a prayer, and I just knew that it was going to be answered. But guess what? It was not answered. It was answered, but it wasn't answered in the way that I wanted it to be. God's will and our will is not necessarily the same. We're trying to get to that point where our wills align, God's will and our will. But it's difficult for us to get to that point. It may sometimes be messy, the things that happen to us. Oftentimes they are. It's not straightforward. It is not straightforward, and it is, as I just mentioned, confusing for us sometimes, because the things that happen, you know, who was prepared for COVID? Nobody that I know of was. I'm not sure if anybody was. Even those who were intimately involved with it, I'm not sure if anybody was prepared for COVID. It came up from a direction behind us that we had no inkling of something like this happening. We have a picture in our mind most of the time. You know, prophecy marches on, and we have a picture of our mind how that's going to take place. Very rarely does it happen the way we think it will, or the picture that we have in our mind. It may test our faith, the plan that God has to make us better. When this prayer that I was just speaking about, when it happened, it tested my faith. It tested my faith. Hopefully I came out on the other side of it down the road stronger and more. My faith was encouraged and my faith was bolstered by it, but at the time it didn't seem like that, and that can happen to us. James, the first chapter, we're going to go to a shopworn scripture here that we very, very often go to, as the one song says so many times, that our memories are worn, we have a path to it in our memory. It's in James, the first chapter. And James, and here's one of the most difficult scriptures, admonitions to obey, maybe in the whole Bible. It says in verse 2, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials." Trials are not fun. Trials are not joyful. At least not for the time being, and not while they're happening. As I just mentioned in that list of things that can happen to us, we don't like it, generally speaking. I don't, maybe you do, but I sure haven't learned to like them yet and count it all joy, at least to this point. But it says, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. It produces perseverance. It produces, as it says here, patience. It's for production. It's for producing something. It's for producing fruits. That's why things happen to us, to make us better. God is trying to refine us and make us better. Verse 4 says, let patience have its perfect work, because there's even a step beyond perseverance, patience, and so forth. Let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. Now, the Life Application Bible has an interesting commentary on verse 4 here. It says, we can't really know the depth of our character until we see how we react under pressure. Let me read that again. We can't really know the depth of our character until we see how we react under pressure. Romans, the 5th chapter, adds just a little bit more to this. Romans 5. Romans is, of course, one of the books, that letters that Paul wrote. But in chapter 5, verse 3, it says, again, we glory in tribulation, knowing that tribulation, as he said before, produces perseverance. In other words, endurance, patience. And perseverance produces tribulation, produces perseverance. Perseverance produces character. Not just any kind of character. We know a lot of characters, and they're not necessarily the kind of characters that this is talking about. It produces approved character. It produces character that is refined. It produces tried character. It produces righteous character. And that's what we're after. So how do we respond to pressure personally? Just think about that for a minute. How do you respond when pressure hits us? And I know for a fact that oftentimes we may not be quite prepared to act in the way that maybe we should have, could have, or would want to. But that's what it's all about, getting us prepared to respond in the right way. God's people in all ages have had trials and testing and pressure on them. We think maybe the pressure we have is extreme, or we think maybe the pressure we have is above and beyond whatever anybody else has had. But think about it. Is that the case? No, it's not. Think, for example, of Daniel and the lion's den. Now, we know how that all turned out. We have the benefit of hindsight. We know what happened when Daniel was thrown into the lion's den. But Daniel didn't know. When he was being thrown into the lion's den, he was hoping God would save him, but he didn't know, because it hadn't happened yet. He had to go through it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, the same thing. They even said that our God, they told Nebuchadnezzar that our God can save us, and he might save us, but even if not, we're going to do the right thing. Either way, doesn't matter, we're going to do the right thing. John the Baptist, Stephen, Paul, none of them knew what was going to happen. They did not have the outcomes that Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego had. John the Baptist did not know that he was going to lose his head in prison, but he did. Stephen did not know that he was going to be stoned, but again, he was. He was the first Christian martyr. Paul, there's a list, I forget which book, I think in Philippians, of all the different things that Paul suffered. Now, he had some inkling of things he was going to suffer, because God had told him that some of the things that he was going to have to experience. But he certainly probably didn't know the exact time, place, and so forth. We, as I mentioned, have the benefit of hindsight, and we know the end of the story. They did not. So I want to pose a couple of situations or circumstances for us, and I want us, it's difficult to do, but I want us to play along for a little bit and pretend we didn't know the outcome of these circumstances and try to think, how would we have reacted in those circumstances? What would we have done? How would we have responded under the pressure that these people faced in that time and in that place? These were real people. They were people that existed in a time and place in time. They were real people with, they got hungry when they didn't have anything to eat. When they got hit, they hurt. They had fears like you and I. They were real people. There's an old hymn that I love, this hymn, and the title of the hymn is "I Love to Tell the Story." It's a great hymn. And I do love to tell the stories of the Bible, because here's what happens. The more we repeat them, the more often we go through them, the more real they become to us. The characters in the story become more real to us, and we are able to identify with them a lot more than we just take a casual reading and read over it. The more we do that, the more these people are real, the more these people, we realize that they're not just a story in a book. They're not just a person that, you know, whether it's true or not. No, it's not that. They're real people in a real place at a real time. The story that I'm going to relate first or talk about first is a story that we repeat every year as we come to the Passover and for the spring holidays. And that's the story of the Exodus. Now, we won't do a whole long, expanded whole Exodus story, but I want to talk about it for a little bit. And as I mentioned, I'd like for you and me to try to put ourselves in the position of these people. Most of it's found. The bulk of the story is in that we're going to be dealing with today is in Exodus, the 14th chapter. Exodus, the 14th chapter. Now, we oftentimes, or sometimes, we think that this was just a large group of people thrown together, and they, you know, trampled over each other trying to get out of the country of Egypt. But that's not the case. Just backing up into chapter 13 of Exodus, and in verse 18, it says, "The children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of the land of Egypt." And the reason, one of the reasons for that was they had a person that was uniquely qualified to lead them out of the country or the land of Egypt. And that person was, as we know, Moses. Moses, his life was sort of divided into three parts. He died at 120 years old. The first part of it was he was brought up in Egypt under Pharaoh's regime. He was part of the ruling class of people in Egypt. Many people feel that he was the commander of the Egyptian army, which was the greatest army or the greatest world power that the world had seen up to this point. They were the most powerful nation, most powerful army in the world in their day at that point. And Moses, as I mentioned, was uniquely qualified to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, because he was trained. He was trained in the land of Egypt how to do those kind of things, how to organize, how to designate people for different things. Then his second part of his... For a reason that most of us know a little bit about, he was sort of fled Egypt because he had sided with the children of Egypt, or children of Israel, and somebody saw him do that. But anyway, we won't get into that story necessarily. But then he went out into the land of Midian, and he chased sheep and goats around, big flocks, for another 40 years out in the wilderness. So he knew about the wilderness. He trained in the wilderness how to how to be able to survive out there, how to get food, how to keep his sheep, his flock, which he had a different kind of flock later on, but how to keep his flock organized, how to keep them together, how to keep them from going astray. They went from one place trying to find food to another place trying to find food and so on. But anyway, Moses, as I mentioned, was uniquely qualified for what he did. But now think about this. Here we are going to be going out of the land of Egypt. There had been talk of this and organizing and preparation for this. It didn't just happen overnight that one night they said, we're leaving tonight, and boom. It took some time. They worked at it. And so here you are. We're going to make you a family of four, of six, four children. And you take your donkey and you hitch it to that rickety old cart. And you're getting ready. Now you're excited, but you're also pretty apprehensive because this is some brand new. They call it prisoners. Oftentimes, even prisoners, they like the comfort of having, being told what to do and all the different things that they encounter in prison. And oftentimes, they would rather go back there than be out where they can have freedom. This might have been a little bit like that here. At least here, they knew what was going to happen. They knew how things were going to be run. They knew what was going to be done. So there was excitement, but there was also apprehension. They were worried about it. You would have been worried if you were hitching your donkey up to the cart and you would have been getting ready and prepared to follow that next person in front of you, that next group of people and their animals and so on, to follow them out of the land of Egypt. You would have had some hesitation. You got your boys, the older boys, you got them to round up the few goats and the few sheep that you had, and the geese. Of course, you had to take the geese, but geese are not easy to try to herd along. They're pretty difficult to try to get marching along. They had their wings clipped so they couldn't fly, but they could still hop, and they'd go off everywhere. But the boys did a good job, kept them in the group, and here they go. And, of course, the older daughter, she got to take care of the baby because we can't carry the baby all the way from Egypt to the Promised Land, to Canaan. So the baby had a spot in the cart with all the other things that were in there, the clay dishes and ceramic dishes that had been handed down for generations, which were, to them, they were hand-me-downs, like hand-me-down clothes, but they were their heritage. Grandma had them, great-grandma had them, mom had them, and so on. Now you have them. And they took those, and of course, they had to take the tent. The tent took up the biggest portion of it. Now, the tent was a goat hair tent, a tent made out of goat hair. And goat's hair, it was like a screen door almost because it had little openings in it so that in the summer when it was hot, it'd leave some of the bottom open and the air could flow in under there and it could go up through. There was an airflow with a big cooling effect in the tent, kept the sun off, but there was air movement. But you say, well, what happens when it rains? Well, as it just so happens, goat's hair, when it rains, it expands, swells up, and those little holes close up. And now it's watertight, it's waterproof. But they've been preparing that for months, getting ready to hit the road and get on the road. So they left Ramses and the land of Goshen and headed east because the land of Canaan was northeast from where they were. Egypt is here. Canaan is over here, northeast from where they started out. They went from there to Succoth, and from there they went to Etham. Now, everybody at that point, well, I should point out that a cloud had formed, and what they were doing is they were following this cloud. Everybody could see the cloud up in the sky, and they would follow that cloud. And then at night, that cloud turned into a pillar of fire to illuminate the camp. It wasn't so bright that you couldn't sleep, but it was bright enough to make sure that people could see. So they'd follow that cloud, and when the cloud went left, they went left. When the cloud went right, they went right. So they got to Etham, and now it's time to turn north and northeast to head to the land of Canaan. But is that what they did? Nope. Cloud went to the right. It went south. And maybe that's where the expression comes from. Things went south, I don't know. Possibly. But anyway, they went south along the Red Sea. And pretty soon, guess what else happened? There were mountains to your right. At first, they were a little in the distance, and as you kept on going further and further, they kept closer and closer. And the next thing you know, you were in a box canyon with surrounded by mountains on the right and in front, and the Red Sea to the left. Now, where are we going to go from here? To make matters worse, they look behind them, and here comes Pharaoh and his army charging hard after them. Guess what they did? They did what a lot of people would do, and I'm going to ask a question about this. Verse 10 of chapter 14, it talks about this a little bit. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid. Very afraid. And I'm guessing a lot of us would have been as well. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, here's where the accusations and the whining starts. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Didn't we tell you so? We told you so, it says in verse 12. Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone, leave us serve the Egyptians? And I'm sure a lot of them did. Now the question that I want to ask is, which side would we have been on? The ones that cried out to the Lord and said, Lord, please save us. We trust you. We know that you're going to take care of us, so we're not afraid. Please save us and help us. Or would you have been the ones that have yelled at Moses and the Aaron and the leaders and said, I told you so. We told you so. It's a question for us to consider. Now remember, you did not know at this point what the outcome was going to be. You were down here and you had no way of knowing what was going to happen. Well, we know now what was going to happen because God had Moses take his rod, stretch it out over the Red Sea, parted the waters, dried it off, and they walked across on dry shod. But it looked pretty bleak there for quite a while before that happened. And again, as I said, we have the benefit of hindsight and we can see what happened to him. It's easy for us to think, well, why should they have been afraid? In verse 13 of Exodus, the 14th chapter, and here is one of the phrases that I think we want to keep in mind. Says, Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. And again, that's very easy to say when you're on dry ground and you're on, you know, on the mountain looking out over things, rather than penned up against the sea with the Egyptian army bearing down on you. But he said, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. It's one thing that we want to keep in our mind. That's one thing that we want to keep in thinking about when things get tough, when things get tight, when things become a little more or less more uncomfortable, when things get harder to understand. Keep this in our mind. That's one of the phrases that we want to keep in our mind, and that is, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Now, there we're going to move on from this particular. We already, I think I mentioned that, you know, the outcome of this. The Red Sea parted and they went across, and then the waters came back, and the Egyptians tried to do the same thing, but they didn't realize that this was only for the chosen, and it wasn't going to happen to them. They were not going to be able to do that. But the next story is going to be in 2 Kings. It's a shorter story, but many of us have heard the Bible talks about leprosy. And this is sort of the lead up to the real story. But Naaman was the commander of the Syrian army, and the Syrian army was at war with Israel. Has anything changed in the last 2,500 years? Same people, same wars, still going on in the same area. It's just the way life has worked out. But Syria was at war with Israel, and they'd made raids into the nation of Israel, the house of Israel, which was the northern 10 tribes in Samaria. They'd make raids. They'd go in, they'd bring plunder back, and they'd even bring human plunder back. They'd bring people back. And they brought this little girl back, and she was became the servant of the commander of the Syrian army of his wife. Naaman was the commander. And so she convinced Naaman to go to Elisha. Now, Elisha was the successor to Elijah. He got a double portion of Elijah's spirit. And Elisha had a lot of God's spirit to work with, and he did a lot of miracles, or a lot of miracles were done through Elisha. So he healed, God healed him, but through Naaman, or through Elisha, he healed Naaman of his leprosy. But the raids may have ceased for a little while, but then right they were right back at it in chapter 6 of 2 Kings. 2 Kings, the 6th chapter. They were right back at it and going back to war with Israel. It says in verse 8, the king of Syria was making war against Israel. And he consulted with his servants, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place. Well, in verse 9, that was verse 8, it said, the man of God sent to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you do not pass. In other words, he was getting intel from God in advance of what the Syrian army was going to do. And he said, don't go there. They're going to be there, so you be here. You be somewhere else. Don't go there. And, of course, after a little while, the king of Syria became pretty perturbed. He thought that there was some kind of a spy in their group. Somebody was telling the king of Israel what was going on so that they weren't able to get the army. They weren't able to do what they wanted to do, and he was accusing his commanders and his ruling class in the army. He was commanding them, or he was accusing them of somebody was a spy. Somebody is telling the king of Israel what we're going to do before we even get a chance to do it. But one of his servants, in verse 12, told the king, in verse 11, the end of verse 11, would you not show which of us is for the king of Israel? Because he figured somebody is defecting here, or somebody is a double agent. Well, one of his servants said, none, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet, who is in Israel, he tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. He knows what you're saying in private. He knows what you're thinking. You don't probably even have to say it, and he'll know it. And he'll be able to tell the king of Israel so that they can avoid being attacked. So they said, well, go and see where he is, meaning Elisha, that I may send and get him. And it was told him, saying, surely he is in Dothan. Now, Dothan is still a contested area. It's a portion of the West Bank. And it was, you know, important in those days, and it's important now to some people. But it was told him, saying, surely he's in Dothan. Therefore he sent horses and chariots and a great army there, and they came by night, and they surrounded the city of Dothan, all around the city. The whole army was around the city. They came at night, and when the servant of, and this is verse 15 of chapter 6 of 2 Kings, when the servant of the man of God, being Elisha's servant, arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, alas, my master, what shall we do? Now, what would we have thought? We're surrounded by armies. What would our response have been? What would our reaction have been if that would have happened to us? We'd have probably had that same response that this servant of Elisha's did. But Elisha said, do not fear, and here's the second thing I want you to keep in mind. Keep in your mind for future use when you're between a rock and a hard place. He said, do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Now here, an unusual thing happened. It didn't happen to Daniel. It didn't happen to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It didn't happen to the Egyptians. But here's something unusual that happened, and I think this may have been the only place that at least that I can think of or know of that this happened. Elisha prayed and said, Lord, I pray, open his eyes that he may see. And that was his servant's eyes. He wanted his servant to be able to see. Now Elisha, he had no hesitation. He knew what was going on. I don't know if he instinctively, intuitively knew or if God had shown it to him. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Now, you think about it. When we get in trouble, when we have problems, when we struggle, when things are happening and we feel like we're surrounded by armies, don't you think that same thing is happening? That God has an army around us for his will to be done? I would think so. I would think that that would be the case. But we obviously, we don't know that like they did. But again, keep this in mind. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. That's in verse 16. It's something that can hold us or serve us in good stead when we are fearful, when we are struggling, when we hurt, when we feel like that we are surrounded by armies. We are surrounded by Satan's evil armies. But there are more for us than there are for them. And that's what the question now is, what about us? What about us? We don't know how our stories will end. We don't know what's going to happen because it's not written yet. It's not finished yet. We all know that someday we will come to our end. That we know. But between now and then, we don't know what's going to happen or how things are going to take place. When things aren't going the way we'd like them to be going, how do we respond? How should we respond? We should keep those two things in mind. When we come up against our Red Sea, again, which side of the fence are we on? The side that's complaining and the side that's whining and the side that's fearful? Or are we going to be on the side that's asking God, that is, has the faith to believe in God and know that God will take care of us? Sometimes, as he did with Jesus Christ just before the crucifixion, sometimes it doesn't change the story. Sometimes it doesn't change what's going to happen. But sometimes God, instead of delivering us, Sometimes God will strengthen us so that we can make it through those times, those difficult times when things are happening to us that we wonder if God has forsaken us, if God has left us and we're on our own. Sometimes that happens. When we're surrounded by enemy armies, how do we respond then? Do we think it's insurmountable? That nope, this cannot be overcome? We think that that's too much for God to take care of? And we wonder why God isn't coming to our rescue, coming to our aid? God has a plan to make us better. He has a plan to refine our character, to make more righteous character in each and every one of us. It's not easy. It's not what we sometimes would want. It's not the kind of thing that we ask for. And we certainly, as James said, we certainly oftentimes don't count it all joy because it's not pleasant. It's no fun. But once we've gone through it, then we can see the benefit of it oftentimes in hindsight. When we are sick, and that's no fun, all of us have probably been sick at one time or another with various degrees of illnesses, some very serious, some temporary, but we've all had illnesses. When we are sick and we feel like we're surrounded by the armies of Satan, do we remember that? Do we remember that there are more of for us than there are for them? We need to. When we can't seem to make ends meet, the paycheck comes in and the bills come in. The bills are this high and the paycheck is this high. We just can't seem to make that struggle to make ends meet. Do we rely on God then? When the pressure is on, how do we respond then? When we are persecuted by family and friends, and that happens a lot, it has happened in most people's life that they were persecuted by family and friends because of our beliefs, because we believe something different than what is the norm, than what most people think or most people believe. What do we do then? Do we rely on God or do we cave in? When we have doubts and fears, how are we going to respond then? And we do have doubts and fears. All of us do at times. It's part of the human experience. In other words, when life happens, how do we react to it or how do we respond to it? It's not that easy. It's not that easy because it often, very seldom does it come at us straightforward. It comes, Satan looks for those little chinks in the armor, those little places where those fiery darts can hit us between the links or the links of our armor, which is why it's so important that our armor constantly be replenished. When those things happen, do we respond with faith or do we respond with fear? We have options and choices. We can respond with faith in God. Our faith can grow. It can become stronger. Our endurance and perseverance can grow. And our patience, and it can become stronger along with our faith. Or we can allow it to chip away at our faith and let it deteriorate. The point is that we need to build on our faith. Hebrews 11:1, which is the faith chapter, says that faith is the evidence or the belief of things not seen. It's the belief in those armies that are up there to help us that we can't see. That's what faith is, to know that God is there whether we see him or not. Faith is the belief in things that we cannot see. But keep those things in mind that we just read. There is more than meets the eye. There's a lot more than meets the eye. There are things going on around us in the spirit world that we have no idea that are there. I often think, and I've been on a number of occasions, I have been to someone's house when a saint died, one of God's people died. And I often feel like at that point I know that I'm in the presence of God and his angels, because God is there for his saints. God is there for his saints. But we rarely get to see what we don't know. Elisha's servant did, but that was the exception to the rule. There's very few times that happens. We don't hardly ever get to see that. The Israelites at the Red Sea, they didn't. They didn't know what was going to happen. They saw the mountains, they saw the Red Sea, and they saw Pharaoh's armies behind them. That's all they could see. That's all they knew. But Moses knew better. Moses knew that God was working to make them better, that God had a plan, and he was working to try to make sure that they got better, became better, had better character. Daniel didn't know that when they threw him in the lion's den, but he was prepared to die if that's what God required. He was prepared. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the same thing. They did not know what was going to happen before it happened. Just like we don't know what's in the future, what's going to happen in front of us when we're facing things. They didn't know that either. Only Elisha's servant was the only one that I can think of in the Bible that got the benefit of seeing what was there that he was not able to see, that he didn't know, that he hadn't been able to see up to that point. Again, trials and testing produce endurance, patience, and patience produces character, righteous character, tried and proven character. We're here to develop the faith to know that God is there even when we can't see him or feel him, and the character to act accordingly, to know that God is there and to act accordingly. Genesis 18:14. This is one of the things that I always have been encouraged by. God had come excuse me, to tell Abraham and Sarah, and they were in their 90s. They were getting up there in age, and God came and told them, you're going to have, next year this time, you're going to have a son. And both of them laughed, because they knew, can we have children at our age? They knew it wasn't possible. But in verse 14 of chapter 18 of Genesis says, is anything too hard for the Lord? And obviously the answer is no. The Lord can accomplish anything. He can do anything to accomplish his purpose. And that's what we need to keep in mind, that nothing is too hard for the Lord. In 2 Peter 2:9, it says that the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of trials. And sometimes that's not the way we would think. Sometimes that's not to take the trial away. Sometimes that's just to strengthen us and make us stronger. That's just the way he works sometimes. It's not necessarily the thing that we hope that happens. But what it is, it's the way that God works in our life to make us better, to refine us, to create righteous character, to help develop righteous character in us. And I'll just leave you with this, and that is the thing that I want you to remember from this message. First of all, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, because those who are for us or with us are more than those who are with them.